May it please the Court. Good morning. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. This case is about the potentially lifetime psychiatric commitment as a sexually violent person, or SVP, of a man who committed a single rape over 20 years ago, who has already been held criminally responsible for his crime, and has already served his time and paid his debt to society. The Constitution permits the extraordinary remedy of indefinite civil confinement only where it is medically justified. For SVP commitment, the Constitution requires at a minimum two elements. One, that a person suffers from a validly diagnosed psychiatric disorder, and two, that this disorder is shown to negatively affect the person's ability to control his sexually violent behavior. The Constitution requires this standard of proof in order to distinguish truly sick individuals who do not choose to do bad things and cannot be deterred within the criminal system from other potentially dangerous criminals and recidivists who can choose and are subject to criminal punishment. Michael McGee, my client, was civilly committed on the basis of so-called not otherwise specified psychiatric disorders that do not meet these two elements. First, Mr. McGee's purported disorders are diagnostically invalid and not recognized by the psychiatric profession. In our brief, we cited a whole series of scientific and academic authorities in support of this fact, and in their response, the state cited none. This is not a dispute or a controversy. The state essentially conceded that these disorders aren't recognized outside of SVP courtrooms. Now, second, and because of this fact, but also because of the very nature of these unspecified, amorphous, not otherwise specified diagnoses, there remains no evidentiary basis, either in this record or outside the record and subjected to judicial notice, that would support the constitutionally required showing that these are valid disorders that cause serious volitional impairment, or that these disorders are somehow reliable predictors of sexually violent behaviors. Now, Justice Kennedy warned against the kind of diagnosis that was used on Mr. McGee when he cast the swing vote in Kansas v. Hendricks, the case that authorized SVP commitment. Justice Kennedy wrote, "If it were shown that mental abnormality is too imprecise a category to offer a solid basis for concluding that civil detention is justified, our precedents would not suffice to validate it." Mr. McGee's diagnosis of a not otherwise specified mental abnormality was too imprecise and simply unrecognized to justify lifelong detention as an SVP. This is why we're asking this court, at a minimum, to do what the Supreme Court did in Kansas v. Crane when it encountered a diagnosis that didn't specify enough about its underlying elements, and to grant the writ and remand Mr. McGee's case to the trial court for a hearing conducted in accordance with the Supreme Court's due process standard for indefinite civil commitment.
What you say unrecognized, certainly there were psychologists who testified at McGee's hearing that recognized the mental disorder and gave their reasons for that, correct?
Two experts testified at the hearing. One was a PhD in psychiatry, as I understand, and one was a PhD in urban education. They claimed that these disorders were derived from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of, well, they didn't actually correctly name it, but it's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 4th edition. And they pointed that these disorders, or the diagnoses of these disorders, were derived from categories called the not otherwise specified categories. Now, this wasn't pursued at all in any detail in the court, but these categories are catch-all categories that are at the back.
Some refer to them as garbage diagnoses.
Well, neutrally, we can call them a bucket. And these are bucket diagnoses at the end of every chapter, not just in the personality disorders or the sexual. They're also at the end of the anxiety disorders, the eating disorders. It's just a not otherwise specified diagnosis. And it's there, according to the DSM, when there's a mixed presentation or an atypical presentation and the clinician hasn't gotten enough information to be able to make a specific diagnosis, but you need to move forward with treatment.
Or a condition that just doesn't quite fit one of the consensus categories that DSM has recognized.
Correct.
Where there is a disorder, a person that's not functional, or functions in a way that is abnormal but just doesn't quite fit one of the categories.
Correct. I think that would be under the atypical category in some way. And the problem with that and our issue here at this point is that this doesn't rise to the level. If you haven't yet specified what the disorder is, if you have symptoms but you can't find the disorder, then you're not meeting the due process standard.
So unless DSM and the American Psychological Society accepts it as one of the recognized descriptions, then it cannot justify the court's adjudication.
We're not asking for that.
That's a due process violation.
No, we're not asking for that kind of a categorical recognition that it has to be in the DSM. In Kansas versus Crane, what the court said is we first need to start with a psychiatric diagnosis, and I think it's fair to understand that that means a valid rather than an invalid diagnosis and some sort of a recognized diagnosis and not one that's been invented on the spot. And it says that from the nature and severity of that diagnosis, certain conclusions have to be drawn to ascertain that this is sufficient to satisfy due process, that there's really that this person's not able to choose their violent behavior, and that here we have a reliable basis because of this psychiatric diagnosis. Here we have a reliable basis to predict that this person isn't going to be deterred by criminal punishment. And in all the cases that we're relying on, Kansas versus Crane, Kansas versus Hendricks, they turn first to the DSM because it is really internationally the recognized standard, minimum standard for diagnosis. But the court,
you know, in medicine, I'm not unaware that we've got another sort of handbook that you got to look at to say, well, this is what it is. I mean, physical things are much easier to describe, and here we don't have that, do we? In other words, because it's mental, we're unable to see it. We don't have that kind of diagnosis other than this handbook.
Correct, other than the handbook. And I think that also brings up an important fact, that the handbook and the importance of having valid psychiatric testimony and having valid disorders is essential to meet the due process standard, because if you make this diagnosis in the courtroom, if there's no underlying validity to the psychiatric basis for the diagnosis, then you're going to end up with a diagnosis essentially occurring in the courtroom. And I think this is exactly what Justice Kennedy was talking about when he said, now, if this gets too imprecise, if we're just saying mental abnormality, but we can't see that this is a solid basis to put a person away potentially for life, then nothing in our precedents are going to validate this. And I think it's important to see that in the precedents, they turn to the DSM. It's right there. They use the diagnostic language. They identify which disorder is at issue and how that disorder in Hendricks. And then they reiterate
the fact that this person, there is no, the evidence of record just simply doesn't support that this person has a medical condition as opposed to just being a bad person.
That's what we're saying, that based on this record, there was nothing to cross that line, and that these diagnoses were simply too open-ended to make that differentiation. And the problem with these diagnoses really exists on two levels, commensurate with the two standards set forth in Crane. It's not recognized. We didn't start at the right place, which would be a valid, recognized disorder. And I think you can even see to a certain extent in the court's fact-finding that it was somewhat unclear what disorder we were talking about. The court said, well, maybe it might be this one, maybe
now,
it's the other.
There was some evidence of record, was there not, that there was a medical basis, that there was a medical basis for the diagnosis. I mean, there was some evidence of record.
You could say there's some evidence of record, but
isn't that enough for purposes of our review?
Well, for the purposes of your review, the issue is that in Crane, they said we need to ascertain that even where there's a diagnosis. And in Kansas versus Crane, there was a diagnosis. And in Kansas versus Crane, they said, well, this diagnosis, we've got enough. It fits the statute. And the justices said, well, due process means a certain thing in these cases because we're between the civil and the criminal system. We need to know that the diagnosis does a job. And so, that's again why the DSM alone is not going to do the entire job. We need some sort of specific, reliable ability to ascertain that
Let's get specific, and by analogy to Crane, in the case you have, why is the standard not met? What is there about the evidence of record here that makes that tells us we've got a garbage diagnosis?
Well, what's on the record here that tells us we have a garbage diagnosis are two pretty – it's not – take doesn't take a lot of footwork to ascertain that each of these specific diagnoses were incorrectly derived. First, the evaluator said, this is a personality disorder. We couldn't diagnose an antisocial personality disorder because we didn't have enough to see that this is a long-term personality disorder that begins in pre-adult, which is required by the DSM guidelines. Well, so they fell back and said it could be a personality disorder not otherwise specified with antisocial features. We'll talk about it like an antisocial personality disorder, when, in fact, the general diagnostic guidelines of the DSM said for a personality disorder diagnosis, you need to have this evidence of pre-adult disorder. All personality disorders require this long-term evidence. So in that case, they simply fudged the rules, we could say. In the case of the diagnosis that one of the experts reached on paraphilia, or a sexual disorder not otherwise specified, there's this long-standing knowledge in the psychiatric community that the paraphilia diagnosis was not going to be granted for rape or sexual assault-related behavior because the American Psychiatric Association that puts out the DSM said, we think rape and sexual assault behavior has too many causes to reliably support a diagnosis that this is caused by a disorder. So
the number of conditions under that diagnosis are certainly benign in terms of their injury to a third party. They're nonviolent. They don't involve third parties. Am I right?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
In other words, paraphilia can involve a lot of different conditions that have nothing to do with one's action, much less one's violent action toward a third party.
That's correct. And there is also a paraphilia that's directed towards violent actions. One can be called a paraphilic sadist.
So, in some books, yeah.
Well, and then the sadism diagnosis of paraphilia specifically mentions rape, and it's worth noting that in the DSM, when they want to talk about rape and rape-related behaviors, they speak about it specifically. So to suggest that somehow it's possible to read between the lines, as happened in this case, to adduce a rape-related paraphilia.
My point is the diagnosis is so broad, so amorphous, that it may or may not have anything to do with violent behavior toward another party. Is that right?
That's correct. In the diagnosis reached in our case, it's entirely unclear whether it provides any basis for suggesting that it's related to a third party. So, and if there are no further questions, I see I'm into my rebuttal time, so I'd like to reserve that time.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Schwab. Mr. Weinstein?
I'm Warren Weinstein, an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin, representing the respondent in this case. I think this argument is virtually identical to the argument that was rejected in Hendricks by the U.S. Supreme Court. That in that case, Mr. Hendricks argued that he couldn't be committed because he didn't have a mental illness. Now, the body of law that had developed around mental illness was primarily from the what we call NGI, not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, and it essentially required a psychosis. And Mr. Hendricks said, I don't have that mental illness. I just have, in his case, it was pedophilia, which is a more specific paraphilia. The Supreme Court said, we don't require for mental commitment for the legislatively defined mental condition to exactly fit what the psychiatric community sets forth as its diagnoses. What we require is that there be a mental condition and that it be sufficiently linked to this dangerousness, which includes the ability to control, that it justifies incapacitation of this individual. And this just seems to me to be one step removed from that argument that was rejected. Here now we're to where someone has a personality disorder, which in general we know does qualify, and we're just saying, well, this particular personality disorder doesn't meet the criteria because there's a dispute. I don't think it's fair to say that nobody in the scientific or the psychiatric community believes this is an, quote, invalid diagnosis. There is a school or group of psychologists who do believe that, but they're not it's not the only view held. And it seems to me that the legislature defines what constitutes a mental condition. And I note Justice Kennedy even didn't use a mental diagnosis or a particular kind of, he just said mental abnormality. And the mental abnormality that he was referring to in the Kansas statute is virtually identical to the one in the Wisconsin statute.
Suppose we had a defendant whose diagnosis was character behavior disorder, chronic severe. Would that be enough?
Well, it would depend on the evidence, because what you would have to have would be the psychologist saying this person has this disorder, and the effect of this disorder on this individual is that it predisposes him to commit future acts of sexual violence. It is true that some people with a particular diagnosis would not meet the statutory criteria, but others do. It depends on how the particular diagnosis affects this particular individual. And that's why you have to, seems to me, look at the testimony.
I square that with the language in Justice Thomas's opinion in Hendricks, where he says we don't rely on the behavior, we rely on the diagnosis to make the distinction between people who are medically impaired and those to whom the criminal law should reach.
Well, I think what he meant was there has to be, the legislature has to define a mental condition with sufficient features that one can tell from reading the statute that it focuses on people who are beyond the reach, if you will, of the criminal law.
How did your legislature do that?
It requires that the mental disorder be a volitional or congenital condition that affects the emotional or volitional ability of the individual to and predisposes that person to future acts of sexual violence. It's an entire definition. It requires that there be some congenital or acquired condition, that the condition affects the volitional or emotional ability to control oneself, and that it predisposes the person to commit acts of sexual violence. So even if it predisposes them to commit acts of non-sexual violence, it wouldn't meet the statutory criteria.
But it leaves open the question of whether or not a particular diagnosis fits that definition, right?
Yes, I suppose so. I think what the definition says is that if the psychiatrist gets on the stand and testifies, this person has a mental condition and whatever the name is that it gives them, and for this person, it predisposes them to commit these acts of sexual violence, and it is an acquired, or most of them are congenital, I think, but I don't know, and it affects his volitional ability, then I think the statutory criteria is met. If the person says, well, in this case, it doesn't affect his emotional capacity, or it predisposes him to commit some acts that aren't sexual violent acts, then the statute's not met. But it doesn't seem to me you can sit in the abstract and say a particular diagnosis simply doesn't qualify. Now, I think there probably are some where you would have a very, very difficult time ever getting any testimony that it's a particular diagnosis that predisposes somebody to commit future acts of sexual violence. I've seen a lot of transcripts where psychologists testify this person is an exhibitionist, but that simply doesn't predispose people to commit acts of sexual violence. So it's not, it's in that sense, it's a, quote, non-qualifying mental disorder. But that's not the case with the antisocial personality disorders or personality disorder with antisocial features, both of which are in DSM-IV, but I think the distinguishing factor is this conduct disorder, which is the pre-age 14 diagnosis. And without that, you can't be an antisocial personality disorder. Curiously, I think in DSM-3 you could. But
well, that's right, because it is evolving. It doesn't mean these change.
That's right. I think this is the same diagnosis, as it's just that now we've added this little requirement that requires it to be an antisocial personality disorder, or, a personality disorder with antisocial features rather than an anti-personality disorder.
Let me take you away from that for just a minute on a procedural grounds. What do you feel our standard of review is?
Well, I believe, unfortunately for me, that this is a pre-AEDPA case, because I did take the position in the district court that Mr. McGee had not raised this.
But you agree? You agree? In his Knight petition, he did raise this.
Well, I think it's fair to say that I don't agree, but I don't think that the district court was so far wrong that I can claim he's error.
Right.
It's error.
Thank you.
I think probably the Wisconsin Court of Appeals mischaracterized it, but as with all pro se pleadings, it's very difficult sometimes to characterize these claims. And so I felt that the district court was sufficiently correct that I couldn't successfully argue otherwise.
Sorry for the interruption.
No, that's quite all right. On the issue of the fact finder, however, I don't think Mr. McGee has ever advanced that claim. And as I read Crane, that is a separate claim. I mean, I think the problem in Crane was that Kansas had two separate statutory definitions, one for what it called mental abnormality, and then it had a separate section that dealt with personality disorders. And the personality disorder merely said somebody that has a personality disorder, and the circuit and the court in that, the trial court in that case, had just said personality disorder is a diagnosis in DSM-IV. That was what the instruction said to the jury. So the problem was that this volitional control aspect was never before the jury, either as part of the definition or as separate in the instruction. Every state court that has considered this issue has dealt with it as separate and apart from the requirements of the elements of the offense. What they've treated it as is whether or not the fact finder has to make a specific finding, such, for instance, a special verdict, although not all states use special verdicts, but they all require that the court, that either they have to make a special finding or that the instruction either sets out through the definition of the statute or separately that there has to be this lack of volitional control.
In your experience, are these incorporating the DSM in the instruction, describing?
No, the DSM is not incorporated into the instruction. The jury is given the statutory definition, and the testimony from the experts is subject for argument on the basis of the statutory definition. The court has no further questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. How much time? You have 2 minutes, Mr. Schwab.
Thank you, and I'd just like to address briefly a couple of the remarks from Mr. Weinstein. As Judge Ripple mentioned, you could have virtually a sui generis disorder, as I understood your character behavior disorder, something defined so broadly that we had never heard of it before and didn't know what this disorder entails or what it tells us about a person who's diagnosed. And your question would be, how do we know that this is enough to ascertain that this person cannot control their violent behavior? Similarly, with these not otherwise specified diagnoses, this great bucket where everything that doesn't fit a specific diagnosis falls into the bucket. Well, that when it's in the bucket, it's amorphous. The disorder doesn't tell us anything at that point. Now, Ms. Rheinstein mentioned that the statutory definition is expected then to do all the work of defining what the disorder is and what it tells us. But the statutory definition in many of these cases is drafted as broadly as possible. Congenital or acquired means anything. Emotional or volitional. It covers the entire spectrum. So in these cases, to say the diagnosis doesn't matter, if we just posit the diagnosis and move to this particular case, well, then we've bypassed exactly what we need the diagnosis to do, which is to tell us about this person something that we don't know from their criminal record, something that we don't know from their behavior alone, something that indicates they should be taken outside of the criminal process and put into psychiatric treatment for the rest of their lives, potentially. And without a valid diagnosis, we have no basis to make that judgment, and certainly a statutory finding shouldn't be making that finding, that judgment. The statutory finding should be confirming it, but it should begin, as Justice O'Connor said in Fuchsia, with a medically justified finding. If psychiatric commitment is not medically justified, due process can't support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schwab. The court certainly appreciates you and your firm's willingness to take this case and your fine representation. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.